The Indians from hunger run off contrary to the wishes of the agent to get buffalo, do not attempt to cause their return, or the troops will be placed in the position of assisting in a great wrong. Not until the coming of the cold moons did Agent Miles grant permission for the northern Cheyennes to go out for a buffalo hunt. And then he put some of the southerners to spy on them to make certain they would not run away to the north on the horses he had returned to them. The buffalo hunt was so miserable a failure that the hunters would have joked about it had not everyone been starving for meat. Buffalo bones were everywhere on the southern plains, ghostly heaps of bones left by white hunters, but the Cheyennes could find nothing to hunt but a few coyotes. They killed the coyotes and ate them, and before the winter was over they had to eat all their dogs to supplement the agency's meager rations of beef. Some talked of eating the horses given to them by the agent for hunting, but the chiefs would not hear of this. If they decided to go back north, they would need every horse they could get. All this while, Three Fingers and the tall white man had been trying to get more food for the Cheyennes, but no response came from Washington. When pressed for an explanation, the new Secretary of the Interior, Carl Schurz, said that such details do not in the nature of things come to the knowledge of the Secretary. It is the business of the Indian Office. Yet Schurz had been appointed Secretary for the express purpose of bringing reforms to the Indian Office. He declared that the discontent among the northern Cheyennes was traceable to chiefs who wanted to keep up the old traditions and to keep the other Indians from work. He admitted that appropriations were not sufficient to purchase enough rations to comply with treaty provisions, but hoped that through utmost economy and careful management, the Indian Office would be able to get through the year with only a small deficiency. Some of the Indian Territory chiefs who went to Washington that year found Schurz amazingly ignorant of Indian matters. The Cheyennes called him Maha Ichhon, Big Eyes, and marveled that a man with such enormous organs of vision could know so little. With the coming of the warm moons, mosquitoes began swarming in the reservation bottomlands, and soon the northern Cheyennes were again afflicted with fever and chills. To add to the illnesses, a measles epidemic struck the children. In the moon of red cherries, there were so many burial ceremonies that Little Wolf decided the chiefs must go and confront Agent Miles. He and Dull Knife were both getting old, well past the half-century mark, and they knew it did not matter very much what happened to them, but it was their duty to save the young people, the tribe itself, from being blotted off the earth. Miles agreed to meet them, and Little Wolf was spokesman. "Since we have been in this country, we are dying every day," he said. "This is not a good country for us, and we wish to return to our home in the mountains. If you have not the power to give us permission to go back there, let some of us go to Washington and tell them there how it is here. Or do you write to Washington and get permission for us to go back north?" "I cannot do this now," the agent replied. "Stay here for one more year, and then we will see what we can do for you." "No," Little Wolf spoke firmly. "We cannot stay another year. We want to go now. Before another year has passed, we may be all dead, and there will be none of us left to travel north." Some of the young men then asked permission to add their voices to the council. "We are sickly and dying here," one said, "and no one will speak our names when we are gone." "We will go north at all hazards," another said, "and if we die in battle, our names will be remembered and cherished by all our people." During August, the chiefs counseled among themselves, and a division came among them. Standing Elk, Turkey Leg, and some others were fearful of starting back north. The soldiers would track them down and kill them all. It was better to die on the reservation. Early in September, Little Wolf, Dull Knife, Wild Hog, and Left Hand moved their bands a few miles away from the others, so as to be ready to travel quickly when they knew the time had come to start north. Every day they were making trades, giving up long-cherished belongings for ponies and what few old guns the southern Cheyennes and Arapahoes were willing to part with. But they did not try to fool the agent. In fact, when Little Wolf made up his mind to start north in the drying grass moon, he went to see Miles and told him he was going back to his own country. "I do not want to see blood spilt about this agency. If you are going to send your soldiers after me, I wish that you would first let me get a little distance away from this agency. Then if you want to fight, I will fight you, and we can make the ground bloody at that place." Miles apparently did not believe the dissident chiefs would actually attempt such an impossible journey. He reasoned that they knew as well as he that the army would stop them. Yet he took the precaution of sending Edmund Guerrier, the half-breed southern Cheyenne who had survived Sand Creek in 1864, out to Little Wolf's camp to warn him. "If you go," Guerrier told Little Wolf, "you will have trouble." "We do not want trouble," Little Wolf replied. "We are not looking for anything of that kind. All we want is to get back to where we came from." During the night of September 9th, Little Wolf and Dull Knife told their people to pack and be ready to start at first daylight. They left their teepees standing empty behind them and headed northward across the sand hills, 297 men, women, and children. Less than a third of them were warriors, the strongest of heart in a proud, doomed tribe. There were not enough horses for all, and they took turns at riding and walking. A few young men rode ahead, searching for more ponies wherever they could find them. In the days when the Cheyennes numbered in the thousands, they had more horses than any of the Plains tribes. They were called the Beautiful People, but fate had turned against them, both in the south and in the north. After 20 years of decimation, they were closer to obliteration than the buffalo. For 3 days they traveled as though driven by a common will, straining nerves and muscles, showing no mercy to their horses. On September 13th, they crossed the Cimarron, 150 miles north of Fort Reno, and chose a defensive position where four canyons crisscrossed. Cedar breaks gave the warriors excellent cover. The soldiers caught up with them there and sent an Arapaho guide into the canyons to parley. The Arapaho made blanket signs, warning the Cheyennes to turn around and go back to the reservation. When Little Wolf showed himself, the Arapaho moved closer and told him the soldier chief wanted no fight, but if the Cheyennes did not follow him back to Fort Reno, they would be attacked. "We are going north," Little Wolf replied, "as it was promised we might when we consented to come down to this country. We intend to go peaceably, if possible, without injuring or destroying any property of the white man on the way, and we will attack no one unless we are first molested. If the soldiers fight us, we will fight them, and if white men, who are not soldiers, help to fight us, we will fight them also." Soon after the Arapaho took Little Wolf's reply back to the soldier chief, Captain Joseph Rendelbrock, the soldiers advanced into the canyons and began firing. This was a foolish thing for the soldiers to do, because the Cheyennes were hidden all around them in the cedar breaks. All day and all night they kept the soldiers trapped there without water. The following morning, the Cheyennes began slipping away to the north in small parties, leaving the soldiers to retreat. Now the fight became a running battle across Kansas and into Nebraska. Soldiers swarmed from all the forts, cavalrymen galloping from Forts Wallace, Hayes, Dodge, Riley, and Kearney, infantrymen riding in railroad cars back and forth along the three parallel iron tracks that ran between the Cimarron and the Platte. To keep moving swiftly, the Cheyennes exchanged their tired mounts for white men's horses. They tried to avoid fights, but the ranchers, cowboys and settlers, even tradesmen in the little towns, joined in the pursuit. 10,000 soldiers and 3,000 white men who were not soldiers harried the fleeing Cheyennes unceasingly, thinning the defending warriors, picking off the old and young who fell behind. In the last 2 weeks of September, soldiers caught up with them 5 times, but each time they found their way out. By keeping to rough country, they made it impossible for the soldiers to use wagons or the big guns on wheels. Yet as soon as they escaped from one pursuing column of bluecoats, another was always there to take the place of the one left behind. In the first days of the Moon of Falling Leaves, they crossed the Union Pacific Railroad, forded the Platte, and raced for the familiar sand hills of Nebraska. 3 Stars Crook dispatched parallel columns across their path, but admitted that to catch them would be as hard a task as to catch a flock of frightened crows. In the mornings now there was frost on the yellowing grass, but the crisp air was like a tonic after the long hot summer in Indian Territory. 6 weeks of flight had left their clothing and blankets in tatters. There was never enough to eat. They were still so short of horses that half the men were taking turns riding and running. At one night camp, the chiefs took a count. 34 of those who had started from Indian Territory were missing. Some had scattered during the fights and were making their way north by other trails, but most had died from the white men's bullets. The older people had grown weak, the children were suffering from lack of food and sleep, and few of them could travel much farther. Dull Knife said they should go to Red Cloud's agency and ask Red Cloud to give them food and shelter against the cold moons, which would soon be upon them. Many times they had helped Red Cloud when he was fighting for the Powder River country. Now it was his turn to help the Cheyennes. Little Wolf scoffed at such talk. He was going to Cheyenne country, to the Tongue River Valley, where they could find plenty of meat and skins and live like Cheyennes again. In the end, the chiefs settled the matter amicably. Those who wished to go on to Tongue River could follow Little Wolf. Those who were tired of running could follow Dull Knife to Red Cloud's agency. The next morning, 53 men, 43 women, and 38 children continued straight north with Little Wolf. About 150 turned northwestward with Dull Knife. A few warriors, and the old, the children, the wounded. After some deliberation, Wild Hog and Left Hand also went with Dull Knife, so as to be with their children, the last strong seed of the beautiful people. On October 23rd, Dull Knife's column was only two sleeps from Fort Robinson when a driving snowstorm caught them on the open plain. The heavy wet flakes blinded the struggling marchers, turned the horses' coats white, and slowed their progress. Suddenly, out of the swirling blizzard, appeared a ghostly troop of cavalry. The Cheyennes were surrounded. The soldier chief, Captain John B. Johnson, sent an interpreter forward and quickly arranged a parley. Dull Knife told the captain that he wanted no trouble. All he wanted was to reach Red Cloud or Spotted Tail so that his people could find food and shelter. Red Cloud and Spotted Tail had been moved far north to Dakota, the captain informed him. No longer was there a reservation in the Nebraska country, but Fort Robinson had not yet been closed. The soldiers would take them to the fort. At first, Dull Knife objected, but as dusk came on, there was an icy bite in the blizzard. The Cheyennes were freezing and starving. Dull Knife said he would follow the soldiers to the fort. Darkness came down fast, and the soldiers made camp along a creek, posting guards around the Cheyennes. That night, the chiefs talked uneasily among themselves, wondering what the soldiers would do with them. They decided to dismantle their best guns and pistols, leaving the broken ones to be turned in if the soldier chief ordered them to give up their arms. All through the hours of darkness, they took the guns apart, giving the barrels to the women to conceal beneath their clothing, tying springs, locks, pins, cartridges, and other small pieces to beads and moccasins, as though they were ornaments. Sure enough, the next morning, Captain Johnson ordered his men to disarm the Cheyennes. They placed their broken rifles, pistols, and bows and arrows in a little pile, and the captain let the soldiers take them for souvenirs. On October 25th, they reached Fort Robinson and were assigned a log barracks that had been built to house a company of 75 soldiers. Although the 150 Cheyennes were crowded, they were glad for shelter. The soldiers gave them blankets, plenty of food and medicine, and there was friendliness and admiration in the eyes of the guards who kept watch over their barracks. Each day, Dull Knife asked the post commander, Major Caleb Carlton, when they could go on to Red Cloud's new agency. Carlton told them they would have to wait until he received orders from Washington. To show his sympathy for the Cheyennes, he gave permission for a few warriors at a time to go out after wild game, lending them hunting rifles and ponies. They found but few animals of any kind. The prairie around Fort Robinson was empty and lonely with all the teepees gone, but the Cheyennes enjoyed the freedom to roam without fear, even though it was only for a day at a time. Early in the moon when the wolves run together, their friend Major Carlton left the fort and a new commander came, Captain Henry W. Wessels. The Cheyennes heard the enlisted men speak of him as the Flying Dutchman. Wessels was always darting about the fort, spying on the Cheyennes, entering their barracks unannounced, peering into corners, his eyes searching everywhere. It was during this moon the white men called December that Red Cloud was brought down from Dakota to counsel with them. "Our hearts are sore for you," Red Cloud said. "Many of our blood are among your dead. This has made our hearts bad. But what can we do? The Great Father is all-powerful. His people fill the whole earth. We must do what he says. We have begged him to allow you to come to live among us. We hope he may let you come. What we have, we will share with you. But remember, what he directs, that you must do. We cannot help you. The snows are thick on the hills. Our ponies are thin. The game is scarce. You cannot resist, nor can we. So listen to your old friend and do without complaint what the Great Father tells you." So, Red Cloud had grown old and cautious in his later years. Dull Knife had heard he was a prisoner on his own Dakota reservation. The Cheyenne chief arose, looking sadly on the seamed face of his old Sioux brother. "We know you for our friend, whose words we may believe," he said. "We thank you for asking us to share your lands. We hope the Great Father will let us come to you. All we ask is to be allowed to live, and to live in peace. I seek no war with anyone. An old man, my fighting days are done. We bowed to the will of the Great Father, and went far into the south, where he told us to go. There we found a Cheyenne cannot live. Sickness came among us, that made mourning in every lodge. Then the treaty promises were broken, and our rations were short. Those not worn by diseases were wasted by hunger. To stay there meant that all of us would die. Our petitions to the Great Father were unheeded. We thought it better to die fighting to regain our old homes than to perish of sickness. Then our march was begun. The rest you know. Dullknife turned toward Captain Wessels. Tell the Great Father that Dullknife and his people ask only to end their days here in the north where they were born. Tell him we want no more war. We cannot live in the south. There is no game. Here, when rations are short, we can hunt. Tell him if he lets us stay here, Dullknife's people will hurt no one. Tell him if he tries to send us back, we will butcher each other with our own knives. Wessels stammered out a few words. He promised to let the Great Father know what Dullknife had spoken. Less than a month later, January 3, 1879, a message came to Captain Wessels from the War Department. General Sheridan and Big Eyes Shirts had made up their minds about Dullknife's Cheyennes. "Unless they are sent back to where they came from," Sheridan said, "the whole reservation system will receive a shock which will endanger its stability." Shirts concurred. "The Indians should be taken back to their reservation." In the fashion of the War Department, the order was for immediate action, regardless of the winter weather. It was the moon when the snow drifts into the teepees, the season of bitter cold and raging blizzards. "Does the Great Father desire us to die?" Dullknife asked Captain Wessels. "If so, we will die right here. We will not go back." Wessels replied that he would give the Cheyennes 5 days to change their minds. During that time they would be kept prisoners in the barracks and would receive no food or wood for the heating stove. And so for 5 days the Cheyennes huddled together in the barracks. Snow fell almost every night, and they scraped it off the window ledges for water. But there was nothing to eat except scraps and bones left from previous meals, and the frost in the barracks bit at hands and faces. On the 9th of January, Wessels summoned Dullknife and the other chiefs to his headquarters. Dullknife refused to go, but Wild Hog, Crow, and Left Hand went away with the soldiers. After a few minutes, Left Hand came running out with his wrists manacled, soldiers crowding upon him. But before he was silenced, he shouted so that the people in the barracks would know what had happened. Wild Hog told Captain Wessels that not one Cheyenne would go south again, and the captain had ordered him put in irons. In an attempt to escape, Wild Hog tried to kill the soldiers, but they had overcome him. After a while, Wessels came outside the barracks and talked to them through the windows. "Let the women and children out," he ordered, "so they will no longer suffer." "We'll all die here together, sooner than be sent south," they answered. Wessels went away, and then soldiers came and put chains and iron bars over the doors of the barracks. Night came, but moonlight on the snow made everything outside as light as day. It glittered on the steel bayonets of the 6 soldier guards who stamped back and forth in their hooded greatcoats. One of the warriors pushed the cold stove aside and lifted a section of planking. Below, on the dry earth, were 5 gun barrels, hidden there since the first day. From ornaments and moccasins, they began collecting triggers and hammers and cartridges. Soon they had the rifles and a few pistols back together again. The young men painted their faces and put on their best clothing, while the women made little stacks of saddles and bundles beneath each window so that everyone could leap out quickly. Then the best marksmen among the warriors took positions at assigned windows, each choosing one of the guards outside as his target. At 9:45 p.m., the first shots were fired. At the same moment, every window sash burst outward, and the Cheyennes poured from the building. Seizing the rifles of the dead and wounded guards, they ran toward the line of bluffs beyond the bounds of the post. They had about 10 minutes' start on foot before the first mounted troops galloped in pursuit, some riding in their winter underwear. The warriors quickly formed a defense line while the women and children crossed a creek. Because of their few weapons, the warriors kept firing and falling back, firing and falling back. More soldiers were coming all the time, fanning out into an enveloping arc, and they were shooting every Indian that moved across the snow. In the first hour of fighting, more than half the warriors died, and then the soldiers began overtaking scattered bands of women and children, killing many of them before they could surrender. Among the dead was Dullknife's daughter. When morning came, the soldiers herded 65 Cheyenne prisoners, 23 of them wounded, back into Fort Robinson. Most were women and children. Only 38 of those who had escaped were still alive and free. 32 were together, moving north through the hills and pursued by 4 companies of cavalry and a battery of mountain artillery. 6 others were hidden among some rocks only a few miles from the fort. Among the latter was Dullknife. The others were his wife and surviving son, his daughter-in-law and grandchild, and a young boy named Red Bird. For several days, the cavalrymen followed the 32 Cheyennes, until at last they trapped them near Hat Creek Bluffs in a deep buffalo wallow. Charging to the edge of the wallow, the cavalrymen emptied their carbines into it, withdrew, reloaded, and repeated the action until no fire was returned by the Indians. Only 9 Cheyennes survived, most of them being women and children. During the last days of January, traveling only by night, Dullknife and his party made their way north to Pine Ridge. There they became prisoners on Red Cloud's reservation. Little Wolf and his followers spent the winter in concealed pits, which they dug along the frozen banks of Lost Chokecherry Creek, one of the tributaries of the Niobrara. When the weather warmed slightly in the Sore Eye Moon, they started northward for Tongue River country. On Box Elder Creek they met 2 Moon and 5 other northern Cheyennes who were working as scouts for the Bluecoats at Fort Keogh. 2 Moon told Little Wolf that White Hat Clark was out looking for him and wanted to hold a council with him. Little Wolf replied that he would be glad to see his old friend White Hat. They met about half a mile from the Cheyenne camp, Lieutenant Clark disarming himself to show that he had confidence in their friendship. The lieutenant said that his orders were to bring the Cheyennes into Fort Keogh, where some of their relatives had surrendered and were now living. The price of peace, he added, was their guns and ponies. They could keep the ponies until they reached Fort Keogh, but they must surrender their guns now. "Since I left you at Red Cloud Agency," Little Wolf replied, "we have been down south and have suffered a great deal down there. My brother, Dullknife, took one half of the band and surrendered near Fort Robinson. He thought you were still there and would look out for him. They gave up their guns, and then the whites killed them all. I am out on the prairie and need my guns here. When I get to Keogh, I will give you the guns and ponies, but I cannot give up the guns now. You are the only one who has offered to talk before fighting, and it looks as though the wind, which has made our hearts flutter for so long, would now go down." Little Wolf had to give up his guns, of course, but not until he was convinced that White Hat would not let the soldiers destroy his people. They went on to Fort Keogh, and there most of the young men enlisted as scouts. "For a long time we did not do much except to drill and work at getting out logs from the timber," Wooden Leg said. "I learned to drink whiskey at Fort Keogh. I spent most of my scout pay for whiskey." The Cheyennes drank whiskey from boredom and despair. It made the white traders rich, and it destroyed what was left of the leadership in the tribe. It destroyed Little Wolf. After months and months of bureaucratic delay in Washington, the widows and orphans and the remnant of warriors at Fort Robinson were transferred to Red Cloud's agency at Pine Ridge, where they joined Dullknife. And then, after more months of waiting, the Cheyennes at Fort Keogh were given a reservation on Tongue River, and Dullknife and the dwindling few at Pine Ridge were permitted to join their people. For most of them it was too late. The force was gone out of the Cheyennes. In the years since Sand Creek, doom had stalked the beautiful people. The seed of the tribe was scattered with the wind. "We will go north at all hazards," a young warrior had said, "and if we die in battle, our names will be remembered and cherished by all our people." Soon there would be no one left who could care enough to remember, no one to speak their names, now that they were gone. Chapter 15. Standing Bear Becomes a Person. 1879, January 11th. British Zulu War begins in South Africa. February 17th. In St. Petersburg, Russia, nihilists attempt to assassinate Tsar Alexander. October 21st. Edison exhibits his first incandescent lamp. Henry George's Progress and Poverty is published. First stage production of Henrik Ibsen's A Doll's House. You have driven me from the east to this place, and I have been here 2,000 years or more. My friends, if you took me away from this land, it would be very hard for me. I wish to die in this land. I wish to be an old man here. I have not wished to give even a part of it to the Great Father. Though he were to give me $1,000,000, I would not give him this land. When people want to slaughter cattle, they drive them along until they get them to a corral, and then they slaughter them. So it was with us. My children have been exterminated. My brother has been killed. Standing Bear of the Poncas. The soldiers came to the borders of the village and forced us across the Niobrara to the other side, just as one would drive a herd of ponies, and the soldiers pushed us on until we came to the Platte River. They drove us on in advance, just as if we were a herd of ponies. And I said, if I have to go, I'll go to that land. Let the soldiers go away. Our women are afraid of them. And so I reached the warm land, Indian Territory. We found the land there was bad, and we were dying one after another, and we said, what man will take pity on us? And our animals died. Oh, it was very hot. This land is truly sickly, and we'll be apt to die here, and we hope the Great Father will take us back again. That is what we said. There were 100 of us died there. White Eagle of the Poncas. In 1804, at the mouth of the Niobrara River on the right bank of the Missouri, Lewis and Clark met with a friendly tribe of Indians called the Poncas. The tribe then numbered only 200 or 300, the survivors of a massive epidemic of the white man's smallpox. Half a century later, the Poncas were still there, still friendly and eager to trade with white men. Their sturdy tribe increased to about 1,000. Unlike most Plains Indians, the Poncas raised corn and kept vegetable gardens, and because they were prosperous and owned many horses, they frequently had to fight off raiders from Sioux tribes to the north. In 1858, the year when government officials were traveling through the West setting up boundaries on the land for different tribes, the Poncas gave up part of their territory in exchange for promises made by the officials to guarantee them protection of their persons and property and a permanent home on the Niobrara. 10 years later, however, when the treaty makers were negotiating with the Sioux, through some bureaucratic blunder in Washington, the Ponca lands were included with territory assigned the Sioux in the Treaty of 1868. Although the Poncas protested over and over again to Washington, officials took no action. Wild young men from the Sioux tribes came down demanding horses as tribute, threatening to drive the Poncas off land which they now claimed as their own. The 7 years that followed this treaty, said Peter LeClaire, a member of the tribe, were years when the Poncas were obliged to work their gardens and cornfields as did the Pilgrims in New England, with hoe in one hand and rifle in the other. Congress at last acknowledged the treaty obligations of the United States to protect the Poncas, but instead of restoring their land, appropriated a small amount of money to indemnify the tribe for losses by thefts and murders committed by the Sioux. Then, in 1876, following the Custer defeat, Congress decided to include the Poncas in the list of northern tribes who were to be exiled to Indian Territory. The Poncas, of course, had nothing to do with the Custer fight, had never engaged in any warfare with the United States. Yet someone in Washington arranged for Congress to appropriate $25,000 for the removal of the Poncas to the Indian Territory, and providing them a home therein with consent of said band. That last phrase was as conveniently overlooked as were the promises of the treaty which forbade white persons to settle on Ponca territory. For 10 years white settlers had been intruding on Ponca lands, and their eyes were greedy for the rich alluvial fields on which grew the finest Indian corn on the plains. The first news the Poncas had of their impending removal was brought to them early in January 1877 by a United States Indian inspector, Edward C. Kemble. A white man came there suddenly after Christmas to see us, Chief White Eagle said. We didn't get any news he was coming. He came suddenly. They called us all to the church, and there they told us the purpose of his coming. White Eagle's account of what followed. The Great Father at Washington says you are to move, and for that reason I've come, said he. My friend, you have caused us to hear these things very suddenly, I said. When the Great Father has any business to transact with us, he generally sends word to all the people. But you have come very suddenly. No, the Great Father says you have to go, said he. My friend, I want you to send a letter to the Great Father, and if he really says this, I desire him to send for us, I said. If it be so, and I hear of it the right way, I'll say the words are straight. I'll send a letter to him, said he. He struck the wire. He sent the message by telegraph, and it reached the Great Father very soon. Your Great Father says you are to come with 10 of your chiefs, said he. You are to go and see the land, and after passing through a part, you are to come to Washington. You are to look at the warm land, Indian Territory, and if you see any land that is good there, you are to tell him about it, said he, and also about any bad land there. Tell him about both. And so we went there to the warm land. We went to the terminus of a railroad and passed through the land of the Osages and on to the land full of rocks. And next morning we came to the land of the Kaws. And leaving the Kansas reservation, we came to Arkansas City. And so, having visited the lands of two of these Indian tribes and seen this land full of rocks and how low the trees were, I came to this town of the whites. We were sick twice, and we saw how the people of that land were, and we saw those stones and rocks, and we thought those two tribes were not able to do much for themselves. And he said to us the next morning, "We'll go to the Shikaska River and see that." And I said, "My friend, I've seen these lands, and I've been sick on the journey. From this on I'll stop on this journey, seeing these lands, and we'll go and see the Great Father. Run to the Great Father. Take me with you to see the Great Father. These two tribes are poor and sick, and these lands are poor. Therefore I've seen enough of them." "No," said he, "come and see these other lands in the Indian Territory." "My friend," said I, "take me, I beg, to see the Great Father. You said formerly we could tell him whatever we saw, good or bad, and I wish to tell him." "No," said he, "I don't wish to take you to see him. If you take part of this land, I'll take you to see him. If not, not." "If you will not take me to see the Great Father," said I, "take me home to my own country." "No," said he, "notwithstanding what you say, I'll not take you to see the Great Father. He did not say I should take you back to your own country." "How in the world shall I act?" said I. "You are unwilling to take me to the Great Father, and you don't want to take me back to my own country. You said formerly that the Great Father had called me, but now it is not so. You have not spoken the truth. You have not spoken the straight word." "No," said he, "I'll not take you to your homes. Walk there if you want to." "It makes my heart feel sad," said I, "as I do not know this land." We thought we should die, and felt that I should cry, but I remembered that I was a man. After saying this, the white man, being in a bad humor, went upstairs. After he had gone upstairs, we chiefs sat considering what to do. We said, "He does not speak of taking us to see the Great Father, or of taking us to our own country. We don't think the Great Father has caused this." We had one interpreter there with us, and we said, "As he will not take us back, we want him to give us a piece of paper to show the whites, as we don't know the land." The interpreter went upstairs to see the man and came back and said, "He will not give you the paper. He does not wish to make it for you." We sent the interpreter back again and said, "We want some money from that to us from the Great Father, so we can make our way home." When he came back, he said, "He does not wish to give you the money." White Eagle, Standing Bear, Big Elk, and the other Ponca chiefs, who were left stranded in Indian Territory by Inspector Kemble, now started back home. It was the moon when the ducks come back and hide, and snow covered the plains of Kansas and Nebraska. As they had only a few dollars among them, they walked the entire distance, more than 500 miles, each man with one blanket and no spare moccasins. Had it not been for their old friends the Otoes and Omahas, on whose reservations they stopped to rest and obtain food, few of the older chiefs could have survived the winter journey. 40 days later, when they reached the Niobrara, they found Inspector Kemble there ahead of them. White Eagle's narrative. "Move ye," he said, "prepare to move." "We were unwilling," said I. "I've come back weary. Every one of us is unwilling to move." "No," said he, "the Great Father wishes you to remove at once, and you must move to the Indian Territory." The chiefs were united, however, in their determination to hold the government to its treaty obligations, and Kemble decided to return to Washington to report to the Commissioner of Indian Affairs. The commissioner took the problem to Secretary of the Interior Schurz, who in turn passed it to the great warrior Sherman. Sherman recommended the use of troops to force the Poncas to move, and as usual, Big Eyes Schurz concurred. In April, Kemble returned to the Niobrara, and by using the threat of troops, persuaded 170 members of the tribe to start with him for Indian territory. None of the leading chiefs would go with him. Standing Bear protested so strongly that he was ordered arrested and taken to Fort Randall. "They fastened me and made a prisoner of me and carried me to the fort," he said. A few days later, the government sent a new agent, E.A. Howard, to deal with the remaining three-fourths of the tribe, and Standing Bear was released. White Eagle, Standing Bear, and the other chiefs continued to insist that the government had no right to move them from their land. Howard replied that he had nothing to do with the government's decision. He had been sent there to go with them to their new home. After a four-hour council on April 15th, Howard ended it by demanding a final answer. "Will you go peaceably or by force?" The chiefs remained silent, but before they returned to their homes, a young Ponca hurried to warn them. "The soldiers have come to the lodges." The chiefs knew then that there would be no more councils. They would have to leave their homeland and go to Indian territory. "The soldiers came with their guns and bayonets," Standing Bear said. "They aimed their guns at us, and our people and our children were crying." They started on May 21, 1877. "The soldiers came to the borders of the village," White Eagle said, "and forced us across the Niobrara to the other side, just as one would drive a herd of ponies. The soldiers pushed us on until we came to the Platte River." Agent Howard methodically kept a diary of that 50-day overland journey. On the morning they started, a heavy thunderstorm caused a sudden flooding of the Niobrara, sweeping several of the soldiers off their horses. Instead of watching them drown, the Poncas plunged in and rescued them. The next day, a child died, and they had to stop for a burial on the prairie. On May 23rd, a two-hour thunderstorm caught them in the open, drenching everyone throughout the day. A second child died. Several Poncas fell ill during the night. Next day, they had to ford flooded streams because of washed-out bridges. The weather turned cold. On May 26th, rain fell all day, and there was no wood for fires. On May 27th, sickness from exposure was affecting most of the Poncas. Standing Bear's daughter, Prairie Flower, was very ill with pneumonia. Next day, thunderstorms and heavy rain made progress almost impossible in the deep mud of the road. Now it was the hot weather begins moon, with showers falling almost every day. On June 6th, Prairie Flower died, and Standing Bear gave her a Christian burial in the cemetery at Milford, Nebraska. The ladies of Milford prepared and decorated the body for burial in a style becoming the highest civilization, Howard noted proudly. Standing Bear was led to say to those around him at the grave that he was desirous of leaving off the ways of the Indian and adopting those of the white man. That night a tornado struck the Ponca camp, demolishing tents, overturning wagons, and hurling people hundreds of feet, seriously injuring several of them. Next day, another child died. On June 14th, they reached the Oto Reservation. The Otos, taking pity on the Poncas, gave them 10 ponies to aid in the completion of their journey. For 3 days they waited for high waters to subside. Illnesses continued to increase. The first male adult, Little Cottonwood, died. Howard had a coffin made for him and arranged a Christian burial near Blue Water, Kansas. On June 24th, illness was so prevalent that Howard employed a physician at Manhattan, Kansas, to attend the Poncas. Next day, two women died on the march. Howard saw that they received Christian burials. Now it was the middle of the summer moon. A child of Buffalo Chief died and received a Christian burial at Burlington, Kansas. A Ponca named Buffalo Track went berserk and tried to kill Chief White Eagle, blaming him for the tribe's miseries. Agent Howard banished Buffalo Track from the caravan and sent him back north to the Omaha Reservation. The Poncas envied him for his punishment. Summer heat and biting flies plagued them for another week, and then at last, on July 9th, after a severe drenching and a thunderstorm, they reached the Quapaw Reservation, their new home, and found the small group of Poncas who had preceded them living wretchedly in tents. "I am of the opinion that the removal of the Poncas from the northern climate of Dakota to the southern climate of the Indian Territory," Agent Howard wrote his superiors, "will prove a mistake, and that a great mortality will surely follow among the people when they shall have been here for a time and become poisoned with the malaria of the climate. Howard's ominous prediction proved to be all too accurate. Like the Modocs, the Nez Perces, and the Northern Cheyennes, the Poncas died so rapidly that by the end of their first year in Indian territory, almost one-fourth of them had received Christian burials. In the spring of 1878, Washington officials decided to give them a new reservation on the west bank of the Arkansas, but failed to allot funds for their transfer. The Poncas walked 150 miles to their new land, but for several weeks they had no agent to issue them provisions or medicines. "The land was good," White Eagle said, "but in the summer we were sick again. We were as grass that is trodden down, we and our stock. Then came the cold weather, and how many died we did not know." One of those who died was the oldest son of Standing Bear. "At last I had only one son left. Then he sickened. When he was dying, he asked me to promise him one thing. He begged me to take him, when he was dead, back to our old burying ground by the swift-running water, the Niobrara. I promised. When he died, I and those with me put his body into a box and then in a wagon, and we started north." 66 Poncas made up the burial party, all of Standing Bear's clan, following the old wagon drawn by two gaunt horses. It was the snow-thaws moon, January 1879. Ironically, far away to the north, Dull Knife's Cheyennes were making their last desperate fight for freedom at Fort Robinson. For Standing Bear, this was a second winter journey home. He led his people over trails away from settlements and soldiers, and they reached the Omaha reservation before the soldiers could find them. Big Eyes Schertz, meanwhile, had made several attempts through his agents to arrange for the return of Standing Bear's Poncas to Indian territory. Finally, in March, he asked the War Department to telegraph Three Stars Crook's headquarters in Omaha, Nebraska, ordering him to arrest the runaways without delay and return them to Indian territory. In response, Crook sent a company of soldiers up to the Omaha reservation. They arrested Standing Bear and his Poncas and brought them back to Fort Omaha, where they were placed under guard, awaiting arrangements for shipment to Indian territory. For more than a decade, Three Stars had been fighting Indians, meeting them in councils, making them promises which he could not keep. Grudgingly, at first, he admitted admiration for Indian courage. Since the surrenders of 1877, he was beginning to feel both respect and sympathy for his old enemies. The treatment for Cheyennes at Fort Robinson during the last few weeks had outraged him. A very unnecessary act of power to insist upon this particular portion of the band going back to their former reservation, he bluntly stated in his official report. When Crook went to see the Poncas in the guardhouse at Fort Omaha, he was appalled by the pitiable conditions of the Indians. He was impressed by Standing Bear's simple statements of why he had come back north, his stoic acceptance of conditions over which he had lost control. "I thought God intended us to live," Standing Bear told Crook. "But I was mistaken. God intends to give the country to the white people, and we are to die. It may be well. It may be well." Crook was so moved by what he saw and heard that he promised Standing Bear he would do all he could to countermand the orders for the return of the Poncas to Indian territory. At this time, Crook took action to support his promise. He went to see an Omaha newspaper editor, Thomas Henry Tibbles, and enlisted the power of the press. While Crook held up orders for transfer of the Poncas, Tibbles spread their story across the city, the state, and then by telegraph across the nation. The churches of Omaha sent an appeal to Secretary Schertz to order the Poncas released, but Maha Ichon, Big Eyes, did not bother to reply. A young Omaha lawyer, John L. Webster, then volunteered his services without a fee, and he was soon supported by the chief attorney of the Union Pacific Railroad, Andrew Poppleton. The lawyers had to work quickly to build a case for the Poncas. Any day, General Crook could receive orders from Washington compelling him to start the Indians southward, and then nothing could be done for them. All efforts were bent toward obtaining the cooperation of Judge Elmer S. Dundy, a rugged frontiersman with four main interests in life: good literature, horses, hunting, and the administration of justice. It so happened that Dundy was away on a bear hunt, and the Ponca supporters spent several anxious hours before messengers could find and bring the judge back to Omaha. With Crook's tacit agreement, Judge Dundy issued a writ of habeas corpus upon the general, requiring him to bring the Ponca prisoners into court and show by what authority he held them. Crook obeyed the writ by presenting his military orders from Washington, and the district attorney for the United States appeared before the judge to deny the Ponca's right to the writ on the ground that Indians were not persons within the meaning of the law. Thus began on April 18, 1879, the now almost forgotten civil rights case of Standing Bear versus Crook. The Ponca's lawyers, Webster and Poppleton, argued that an Indian was as much a person as any white man, and could avail himself of the rights of freedom guaranteed by the Constitution. When the United States attorney stated that Standing Bear and his people were subject to the rules and regulations which the government had made for tribal Indians, Webster and Poppleton replied that Standing Bear and any other Indian had the right to separate themselves from their tribes and live under protection of United States laws like any other citizens. The climax of the case came when Standing Bear was given permission to speak for his people. "I am now with the soldiers and officers. I want to go back to my old place north. I want to save myself and my tribe. My brothers, it seems to me as if I stood in front of a great prairie fire. I would take up my children and run to save their lives. Or if I stood on the bank of an overflowing river, I would take my people and fly to higher ground. Oh, my brothers, the Almighty looks down on me and knows what I am and hears my words. May the Almighty send a good spirit to brood over you, my brothers, to move you to help me. If a white man had land and someone should swindle him, that man would try to get it back, and you would not blame him. Look on me, take pity on me, and help me to save the lives of the women and children. My brothers, a power which I cannot resist crowds me down to the ground. I need help. I have done." Judge Dundy ruled that an Indian was a person within the meaning of the Habeas Corpus Act, that the right of expatriation was a natural, inherent, and inalienable right of the Indian as well as the white race, and that in time of peace no authority, civil or military, existed for transporting Indians from one section of the country to another without the consent of the Indians, or to confine them to any particular reservation against their will. "I have never been called upon to hear or decide a case that appealed so strongly to my sympathy," he said. "The Poncas are amongst the most peaceable and friendly of all the Indian tribes. If they could be removed to the Indian territory by force and kept there in the same way, I can see no good reason why they might not be taken and kept by force in the penitentiary at Lincoln or Leavenworth or Jefferson City, or any other place which the commander of the forces might in his judgment see proper to designate. I cannot think that any such arbitrary authority exists in this country." When Judge Dundy concluded the proceedings by ordering Standing Bear and his Ponca band released from custody, the audience in the courtroom rose to its feet, and, according to a newspaper reporter, such a shout went up as was never heard in a courtroom. General Crook was the first to reach Standing Bear to congratulate him. At first, the United States District Attorney considered appealing the decision, but after studying Judge Dundy's written opinion, a brilliant essay on human rights, he made no appeal to the Supreme Court. The United States government assigned Standing Bear and his band a few hundred acres of unclaimed land near the mouth of the Niobrara, and they were back home again. As soon as the surviving 530 Poncas in Indian Territory learned of this astonishing turn of events, most of them began preparations to join their relatives in Nebraska. The Indian Bureau, however, was not sympathetic. Through its agents, the Bureau informed the Ponca chiefs that only the Great Council in Washington could decide if and when the tribe might return. The bureaucrats and politicians, the Indian ring, recognized Judge Dundy's decision as a strong threat to the reservation system. It would endanger the small army of entrepreneurs who were making fortunes funneling bad food, shoddy blankets, and poisonous whiskey to the thousands of Indians trapped on reservations. If the Poncas were permitted to leave their new reservation in Indian Territory and walk away as free American citizens, this would set a precedent which might well destroy the entire military-political reservation complex. In his annual report, Big Eyes Schertz admitted that the Poncas in Indian Territory had a serious grievance, but he strongly opposed permitting them to return to their homeland because it would make other Indians restless with a desire to follow their example, and thereby cause a breakup of the territorial reservation system. At the same time, William H. Whiteman, who headed the lucrative Ponca Agency, tried to discredit Standing Bear's band by describing them as certain renegade members of the tribe. And then he wrote in glowing terms of his considerable expenditures for materials and tools to develop the reservation in Indian Territory. Whiteman made no mention of the discontent prevalent among the Poncas, their constant petitions to return to their homeland, or of his feud with Big Snake. Big Snake was Standing Bear's brother, a giant with hands like hams and shoulders as big as a buffalo's. Like many huge men, Big Snake was quiet and gentle of manner. The Poncas called him the peacemaker. But when he saw that White Eagle and the other headmen were being intimidated by Agent Whiteman, he decided to take action on his own. After all, he was the brother of Standing Bear, the Ponca who had won freedom for his people. Determined to test the new law, Big Snake requested permission to leave the reservation and go north to join his brother. As he expected, permission to leave was refused by Agent Whiteman. Big Snake's next move was not to leave Indian Territory, but to travel only 100 miles to the Cheyenne Reservation. With him went 30 other Poncas, making what they believed to be a gentle testing of the law, which said that an Indian was a person and could not be confined to any particular reservation against his will. Whiteman's reaction was that of any entrenched bureaucrat whose authority is threatened. On May 21, 1879, he telegraphed the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, reporting the defection of Big Snake and his party to the Cheyenne Reservation, and requesting that they be arrested and detained at Fort Reno until the tribe has recovered from the demoralizing effects of the decision recently made by the United States District Court in Nebraska in the case of Standing Bear. Big Eyes Schertz agreed to the arrest, but evidently fearing another challenge in the courts, he asked the great warrior Sherman to transport Big Snake and his renegades back to the Ponca Reservation as quickly and quietly as possible. In his usual blunt manner, Sherman telegraphed General Sheridan on May 22nd, "The Honorable Secretary of the Interior requests that the Poncas arrested and held at Fort Reno in the Indian Territory be sent to the agency of the Poncas. You may order this to be done." And then, as if anticipating Sheridan's apprehensions about flying in the face of Judge Dundy's recent decision, Sherman decreed, "The release under writ of habeas corpus of the Poncas in Nebraska does not apply to any other than that specific case." For the great warrior Sherman, it was easier to unmake laws than it was for the courts of the land to interpret them. And so Big Snake lost his first test of his brother's victory at law, and he never had a chance to try again. After being brought back to the Ponca Agency in the Corn as in Silk Moon, Big Snake was marked for destruction. Agent Whiteman reported to Washington that Big Snake had a very demoralizing effect upon the other Indians, extremely sullen and morose. In one paragraph, Whiteman charged that Big Snake had repeatedly threatened to kill him, and in another complained that the Ponca had never spoken to him since his return. The agent became so furious that he begged the Commissioner of Indian Affairs to arrest Big Snake and convey him to Fort Reno and there confine him for the remainder of his natural life. Finally, on October 25th, Whiteman obtained authorization from Sherman to arrest Big Snake and imprison him in the agency guardhouse. To make the arrest, Whiteman requested a detail of soldiers. 5 days later, Lieutenant Stanton A. Mason and 13 soldiers arrived at the agency. Whiteman told Mason that he would send out a notice to the Poncas, ordering those who had money coming to them for special work to report to his office the next day. Big Snake would be among them, and as soon as he entered the office, Mason was to make the arrest. On October 31st, Big Snake entered Whiteman's office about noon and was told to take a chair. Lieutenant Mason and 8 armed men then surrounded him, Mason informing him that he was under arrest. Big Snake wanted to know why he was being arrested. Whiteman spoke up then and said one charge against him was threatening his, Whiteman's, life. Big Snake calmly denied this. According to the Post trader, J.S. Sherburne, Big Snake then stood up and threw off his blanket to show he was not armed. Harry Bear's statement. The officer told Big Snake to come along, to get up and come. Big Snake would not get up and told the officer he wanted to tell him what he had done. He said he had killed no one, stolen no horses, and that he had done nothing wrong. After Big Snake said that, the officer spoke to the agent and then told Big Snake he had tried to kill 2 men and had been pretty mean. Big Snake denied it. The agent then told him he had better go and would then learn all about it down there. Big Snake said he had done nothing wrong and that he would die before he would go. I then went up to Big Snake and told him this man, the officer, was not going to arrest him for nothing, and that he had better go along, and that perhaps he would come back all right. I coaxed all I could to get him to go, told him that he had a wife and children, and to remember them and not get killed. Big Snake then got up and told me that he did not want to go, and that if they wanted to kill him, they could do it right there. Big Snake was very cool. Then the officer told him to get up and told him that if he did not go, there might something happen. He said there was no use in talking. I came to arrest you and want you to go. The officer went for the handcuffs, which a soldier had, and brought them in. The officer and a soldier then tried to put them on, but Big Snake pushed them both away. Then the officer spoke to the soldiers, and four of them tried to put them on, but Big Snake pushed them all off. One soldier, who had stripes on his arms, also tried to put them on, but Big Snake pushed them all off. They tried several times, all of them, to get hold of Big Snake and hold him. Big Snake was sitting down when six soldiers got hold of him. He raised up and threw them off. Just then one of the soldiers who was in front of him struck Big Snake in the face with his gun. Another soldier struck him alongside the head with the barrel of his gun. It knocked him back to the wall. He straightened up again. The blood was running down his face. I saw the gun pointed at him and was scared and did not want to see him killed. So I turned away. Then the gun was fired, and Big Snake fell down dead on the floor. The Interior Department first issued a statement that Standing Bear's brother, Big Snake, a bad man, had been shot accidentally. The American press, however, growing more sensitive to treatment of Indians since the Standing Bear case, demanded an investigation in Congress. This time the military political reservation complex was operating in the familiar climate of Washington, and nothing came of the investigation. The Poncas of Indian Territory had learned a bitter lesson. The white man's law was an illusion. It did not apply to them. And so, like the Cheyennes, the diminishing Ponca tribe was split in two. Standing Bear's band, free in the north, the others, prisoners, in the Indian Territory. Chapter 16. The Utes Must Go. The army conquered the Sioux. You can order them around, but we Utes have never disturbed you whites. So you must wait until we come to your ways of doing things. Oray the Arrow, Chief of the Utes. I told the officer that this was a very bad business, that it was very bad for the commissioner to give such an order. I said it was very bad, that we ought not to fight, because we were brothers, and the officer said that that didn't make any difference, that Americans would fight even though they were born of the same mother. Nickaagat, Jack, of the White River Utes. The Utes were Rocky Mountain Indians, and for a generation they had watched the invading white men move into their Colorado country like endless swarms of grasshoppers. They had seen the white men drive their old enemies, the Cheyennes, from the Colorado plains. Some Ute warriors had joined the rope thrower, Kit Carson, in the white men's war against the Navajos. In those times, the Utes believed the white men were their allies, and they enjoyed visiting Denver to exchange buffalo hides for gaudy trade goods in the stores. But each year these strange men from the east became more numerous, invading the Utes' mountains to dig for yellow and white metal. In 1863, the governor of Colorado Territory, John Evans, and other officials came to Conejos in the San Juan Mountains to meet with Oray the Arrow and nine chiefs of the Utes. A treaty was signed there, giving the white men all the Colorado land east of the mountaintops, the Continental Divide, leaving the Utes all the land west of the Divide. In exchange for $10,000 worth of goods and $10,000 worth of provisions to be distributed annually for 10 years, the Utes agreed to relinquish mineral rights to all parts of their territory, and they promised not to molest any citizen of the United States who might come into their mountains to dig. 5 years later, the white men of Colorado decided they had let the Utes keep too much land. Through political pressures, they persuaded the Indian Bureau that the Utes were a constant nuisance, wandering everywhere, visiting towns and mining camps, and stealing livestock from settlers. They said they wanted the Utes placed on a reservation with well-defined lines, but what they truly wanted was more Ute land. Early in 1868, with a great deal of fanfare, the Indian Bureau invited Oray, Nickaagat, Jack, and eight other chiefs to Washington. Rope thrower Carson accompanied them as trusted friend and advisor. In Washington, they were quartered in a fine hotel, served excellent meals, and given an abundance of tobacco, candy, and medals. When the time came for treaty